Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Julia Tertian, host of Radio Cherry Bomb. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome back to Roberta's Radio. I'm your sometimes host, Jack Inslee, also the executive producer, here at Heritage Radio Network. And we are back after taking a week off. You may have heard the Thanksgiving episode twice, but it was that good. If you haven't heard that, you should go back and listen to it. We are here live every single Tuesday from 7 p.m. to about 7:30-ish p.m. And if you like the show, we're on iTunes, we're on heritageradionetwork.org, we're on Stitcher, we're anywhere you can find podcasts. Google it. It's very easy. So this week, we have a really great guest in the studio. I think it's actually her second time in the studio. She was on Joe Campanelli's show, In the Drink. It's none other than Amanda Smeltz, who is the wine director and sommelier here at Roberta's and a published poet. What's up, Amanda?
Hi, Jack.
You guys can't see this because you're listening, but we're actually in different rooms. I'm like staring at one wall on the other side here, and she's in the other room. It's
pretty very funny. Contemporary.
Exactly. This is new media. This is what new media looks like, people. I'm really excited to kind of learn more about what you do and the wine program here at Roberta's, which, as we mentioned at the top of the show, didn't exist really when Roberta's opened. And then I think it was Brandon who was the first buyer of wine at Roberta's. And all due respect to Brandon, but I think the program's come quite a long way since those days.
I acknowledge my forebears with gratitude, though.
Yeah, exactly. How long have you been here, Amanda?
About 2.5 years now, actually.
2.5 years. So I kind of want to start... Well, first, let me ask you this. What was the wine program like here when you got here?
It was good. It was a sort of full-fledged Italian wine list, which is in keeping with, I think, how the owners initially envisioned their spot. It had a sort of spanned from north to south Italy, and there was a lot of detail in terms of that country. And it was about the same size, maybe a little bit smaller, but it had been fleshed out a lot by the previous wine director in terms of Italian wine. And what was here when I arrived was a very workable Italian list. But of course I got in and messed it all up.
Right, exactly. That's what we're here to talk about today.
Yeah.
We want to hold you accountable. Well, how did you get into wine? Let's rewind a little bit.
My story on finding work in wine isn't very different from, I think, a lot of other people who work in wine in New York and elsewhere. Almost all of us are in the liberal arts to begin. So you either study the liberal arts and go to law school or business school after that, or you try to find something else to be able to rub two dimes together. And I was working in a fine dining restaurant in the city where I went to college, and I had a former manager from Gramercy Tavern who is the GM at that restaurant, and one day he pulled me aside and was like, "Hey, kid, you seem bored," which was true. So he was like, "You know, we've got 250 bottles on this list, or 300 bottles or so. Why don't you come work in the cellar?" So I did, and it was really an extension. You know, I started serving in restaurants, you know, kind of like a lot of people do. And then I started working as a wine steward in that spot, and I've been doing it for about 8 or 9 years in various capacities since. So I'm still pretty young as far as the industry goes, but, I studied philosophy in college and didn't know what to do for work. And this was something that piqued my interest really quickly because it's a pretty cool extension of a lot of the disciplines in the liberal arts, I think.
Sure. So when you're a server at that restaurant and there's that 200-300 bottle list, I mean, like, how do you start working your way through that? And how much of that list do you actually come to know?
I mean, that was like 8 years ago now or 9 years ago. And I still remember the fair majority of that list. Like, I still remember selling individual bottles off that list. There, you just, you start to build this like Rolodex of wines that you encounter and things that you remember selling and that you remember people, you know, guests having strong responses, good and bad too. And, you know, you sort of don't forget them. It's almost like, I don't know, collecting baseball cards or something. Like eventually you have, you know, a whole set of, you know, the 91 Phillies and you remember every player, right? Even some 15, 20 years later, like you just kind of, you start building the statistics that you know, the little facts that you know, and it, for me it happened kind of bottle by bottle to begin.
Wow, yeah. No, that does make sense. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the list here is quite at 200 yet.
No. It won't ever be. It won't ever be. It hovers around like 120 selections, I think, you know, plus some, like, a bunch of the glass options and dessert wines. I am not looking to build a list of extension. That's the provenance of sort of different kinds of restaurants than the one I'm currently working in.
Yeah, when does that happen? Like, why do some places have enormous lists and then some restaurants have, you know, five wines to choose from?
I mean, a lot of it depends on the intention of the restaurant, you know? Like, I think especially during the 80s and 90s in the U.S. when interest in wine was building super intensely, there were a lot of fine dining establishments that popped up that developed these really intense cellars that were almost like private owners' collections. You know, then they were like libraries for wine, and they still exist, many of them. You know, they're in lots of different cities around the U.S. You know, like when you go to Vegas and you go into a big hotel restaurant that's super fancy and has some famous chef's name blasted on it, you're going to find a wine list that's 300 to 400 bottles strong, no problem.
Because that collection existed already.
Yeah. I mean, that and also because it has something to do with the kind of like, you know, with the kind of accomplishment or, you know, impressiveness, like something that the restaurant wants to convey in terms of its, you know, presence as an institution. You know, and a lot of people, I think a lot of restaurants wanted to do that by showing their breadth, you know, and the depth of their cellar, which is awesome, but it takes a lot of money to do that. You have to have serious investors or private collections that you're, you know, buying from. And even then, that means a lot of money to be able to build, you know, that kind of thing. And then there's the whole question of storage and all this stuff. So anyway, those kinds of wine lists have their place for sure. But they're not my favorite thing in the world. You know, I think that private cellars are pretty amazing, but I think restaurant cellars are kind of frustrating because you're never getting bottles at retail cost or anywhere near wholesale cost. You're always getting them at restaurant markup with very rare exceptions. And that means that those rare bottles that the restaurant has collected in their amazing, long and detailed wine list are expensive. So, you know, I can't drink them. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I would love to be able to. I'd love to be able to go to Tribeca Grill and pound three or four bottles of some of their dope Rhone stuff, but I just don't have the money. You know what I mean? And I think that's not just me. It's a whole lot of people who are into wine who don't have that kind of money.
So let's go back to the Roberta's list then. What makes the list right now unique, and what's kind of the mission behind it?
I mean, it's unique in that it's not it's not focused. its interests, I think, lie in a lot of different diverse regions. I think that if you are looking to come to one restaurant to be able to see something you've never seen before, every time you come here, you will be able to do that. If only because I am habitually interested in esoterica. But yeah, it's brief, but I intend to show things that you've never seen before, and I intend for it to be a sort of a list that's fun to explore that doesn't feel like you have to shell out a lot of money to do that.
Yeah, and how does pizza play into the decisions you're making? And what, if anything, is like, you know, a qualifying factor in pairing wine with pizza?
I mean, I love working here because this is like the perennial question that I get asked when people find out that I'm the wine director at a pizza joint. It's like, oh, well, you know, like, how do you pair wine with pizza? And, you know, the truth is that you can drink anything with pizza. You know, it's like tomato sauce is the one thing that presents a challenge because it's pretty high in acid. But, you know, it's just pizza. It's not rocket science. It's pretty balanced food as it stands. Our pizza isn't even particularly heavy. So you can drink whatever you want with it. You know what I mean? Like, there's lots of white wines that'll sort of contrast off of things that are going on pizzas really well. And then there are obviously plenty of reds, you know, that in their acid and their tannin structure link up to pizza in really traditional and delicious ways. I think that's why my wine list looks the way it does, is because you kind of can't screw it up. There's not a lot of food here, and there's not a lot of stuff that comes out of our pizza oven that's like, oh, no, don't drink that with that, because it's going to be really gross and bad, and you won't like it.
Yeah, totally. But Blanca, I imagine, a totally different story.
Yeah, it gets a little bit more complicated over there, if only because in composing the bottle list, I still want people to be able to come and drink things they've never seen before. I really try to avoid blue chip names and wines and producers over there because, you know, the restaurant is already really expensive, albeit very special. But what I don't want people to do is to come to sit down to dinner and to buy a bottle because they know the famous producer and they've been drinking this famous wine for the last 15 years or whatever. So I do try to avoid, you know, things that are a little bit easier to come by or that are already famous. But you do have to keep in mind whether or not bottles can work with upwards of 20 different courses and different bites of food.
Yeah, what's that pairing like? When, you know, if you get a beverage pairing at Blanca and you kind of leave it up to the sommelier, what does that end up looking like?
It is idiosyncratic. We try to keep it lighthearted. We try to keep it fun. You know, again, it's more about like being exploratory and you know, being a little bit in like a cooking in a wine lab. That's warm and that's friendly, you know, rather than sort of exploring the most classical pairings on the planet with the most stately wines and that, you know, that's sort of not the idea behind the restaurant or the beverage program. It's meant to be a little bit more experimental than that. Then again, I'm not trying to like, you know, I'm not trying to pair wine with anything that's got molecular gastronomy written all over it over there either. So it's not science. It's just fun.
Yeah, no, it seems fun. Something I wanted to ask you about, because, I mean, I'm here every day, and I see you taking so many meetings and tasting so much stuff. I mean, how many wines are you tasting in a week, let's say?
Oh, a lot. To someone who doesn't work in wine, it sounds like a lot. To my peers who work in wine, I'm totally lazy when it comes to tasting appointments. You know, I know people who taste thousands of wines every week. I'd say, you know, on an average week, I'm probably tasting 100 different wines.
Wow.
Yeah. If you go to industry tastings and portfolio tastings, you have to be able to cruise through, you know, easily, you know, 30, 40, 50, 100, and to do it in a sort of efficient manner. That's actually part of that's the thing that you actually need to be trained to be able to do without getting overwhelmed.
Yeah, you're spitting it out, obviously, right?
For the most part. Yeah. But, you know, that's like when you're not tasting the wine for pleasure at that point, right?
Yeah.
You're making assessments and you're figuring out what you make of them very quickly and whether or not you'd like to revisit them again in terms of drinking them yourself or having them on a wine list, you know. So that's sort of the that is the boring professional part of it.
Well, the reason I ask also is because, I mean, not too long ago we had Francine Stevens on. I don't know if you know her from mm-hmm. Franny's.
Yep.
And she was talking about how these days there's just so much trying to be so many people trying to sell wine, and she tastes so much of it. Sometimes she feels like she gets duped, and she'll like agree to buy something and then a month later taste it in the restaurant and say, oh God, like, how did this end up on our list? How, you know, and that feeling of being overwhelmed. I mean, does that ever happen to you? Do you see that in the industry?
I think if you're not careful, if you're not judicious, then it can, which is not to say that Francine is not judicious by any means, but you can easily taste too much wine, right? And you can also go to way too many tastings and you can lose your focus. You have to be sort of deliberate about what regions you're interested in exploring, what producers you don't know anything about, where you need to fill in gaps in your knowledge. You know, if you don't know anything about an importer and you feel curious, if you've heard really good things about a distributor and you need to know, like, those are the reasons that you take appointments, right? Like, it's not just, you know, like, I should just taste every wine that I can possibly taste at all times. Because, you know, a glut of information is not what you need. It's information about wine that's like more specific and a little bit more thoughtful. And I think that eventually leads itself into a thoughtful wine list.
Yeah, for sure. And I want to get into more kind of advice for the layperson, somebody maybe wanting to find a career in wine or just pick out a good wine. So we'll definitely get into all that. I want to take a quick break And shout out Kristen Berry, who's back this week with another playlist. She's always got really awesome tunes for the show. So this is Roberta's Radio. We're talking to Amanda Smeltz, the wine director, sommelier at Roberta's. We will be right back in about a minute or two. Back here. This is Roberta's Radio. Like I said, Jack Inslee here, hanging out with Amanda Smeltz, talking about wine. So much to talk about when it comes to wine, and it can be really daunting for most people, I think. Especially, I mean, do you see that? Roberta's certainly, I mean, the crowd's changed over the years, but for sure there's a real young demographic that comes here and eats here, especially people in the neighborhood. How often are you dealing with tables that are just totally overwhelmed and, you know, don't even know where to start? And then what's that dialogue like for you?
All the time. All the time that's happening. And the dialogue is funny. People have written about it, but I one day would like to see something a little more in depth written about it, about the psychology of American wine culture, because yeah. I notice all the time certain defensiveness. I notice nervousness. I notice, like an unwillingness to converse, and a lot of people. I think largely because the subject seems as obscure as, you know, a higher level arithmetic or something, which it's not. You know, there's lots and lots and lots to know about wine, but it's the same thing as being good at geography, or, you know, like I said before, good at baseball stats, or like, you know, it's the exact same skill set as building a body of knowledge around anything, right? But wine, for a number of different reasons, just sort of seems to off-put people a lot. They want to drink it and they want to enjoy it, but they also have these connotations that, like, if you know something about it, you're this sort of arcane person, and usually snobby. And what I really care about is that that dialogue is possible about wine, and that people feel comfortable asking questions, and that they're encouraged to admit that they don't really know what they're doing. And, you know, that asking for help is not going to get them scoffed at or mocked. So I try to encourage everyone I work with, and for myself too, to be like as warm and inviting as possible on the subject, because it's one that for whatever reason seems to be a little bit fraught. And that's funny because it's just dinner.
Sure. And I'm like, how many people, I mean, I'm guilty of this, especially before I was working here and, like, you know, learning about stuff, but just opening the list and pointing to the cheapest red.
Some. And it's usually kids, and that's totally okay. Mm-hmm. You know, because, like, it's your job as a som and as a wine buyer to be able to find excellent wine at every price point, right? So, like, I didn't pick out a bottle of Kadarka from Hungary that's $40 on our list because it's $40. I picked it out because I think the bottle is really lovely. It just happens to be, you know, pretty affordable too. You know, so like, I'm not bothered when people kind of automatically point their fingers at, you know, $38 and $40 bottles. I don't think that's a problem at all. But you do, you know, it is kind of funny when people look up at you and they go, what's your cheapest red?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and you're like, well, you know, it's these four, but there's still four of them that are all the cheapest bottles. So now you have to talk to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And then, I mean, I imagine some people are afraid of being upsold.
Oh, sure. And I don't like that conversation at all. I've never liked that conversation. It belongs to old corporate restaurants. I don't have any interest in that at all. What I want to know is, like, will people let me show them something that I think they might really like at a price that they feel comfortable with? Like, that's what I'm about. I just want them to have a good time, you know? And I also, it'll make me extra pleased if they encounter something they haven't seen before, just because I happen to really get off on that kind of thing.
Totally. And I want to talk about the staff for a bit, because Roberta's has an enormous staff.
Yes, the village of my peons.
I think there may be a Roberta's currency on its way, even, and a zip code.
Totally.
Just for Roberta's here. But I mean, how do you download all this to the staff and keep them confident? And I mean, I see a lot of staff tastings, but maybe you want to elaborate a little.
Adderall is part of my process. I'm just kidding. You know, I think, you know, one of the things that I really like to do, and that is another sort of analogous career path of mine, is teaching. And one of the things that happens when you're in the classroom is that all you can do is to write a lesson plan to be as engaging as possible, to ask the questions that are, you know, as open-ended and as pointed as possible. And if it falls on some deaf ears, then that's just outside of your control. But sometimes you get really lucky and you get, you know, half the class, or you get 2/3 of the class. And I think that you just have to do it over and over and over again. You have to make information and make teaching accessible to everybody. So we have classes once a week here, which is a lot. Like, I don't really know any other place that holds wine class for its staff once a week. And they're not mandatory, because I think mandatory education is pretty failed. But, you know, what happens is, like, there's a warm culture there, and there's a culture where, like, I give them as much factual information as I can without boring them to tears and oversaturating them, and then I let them do the talking. You know, and that's the most fun thing in the world for me, because I'm watching people sort of discover things for themselves, and I get to watch how, you know, total rookies and also people with some experience behind them, and, you know, more advanced students and less advanced students, I get to watch them articulate something that happens on a physiological level to them, and that is so fascinating. It's really amazing. It's almost like watching somebody learn to speak, only they're like watching them learn how to you know, how to be thoughtful about what they're smelling and tasting, and it's really cool.
Yeah. How, so, you know, if you're not working at a restaurant and you want to build that vocabulary and knowledge base without, like, breaking the bank and buying tons of bottles every week, and, you know, how do you go about that? Where do you even start?
Well, getting a good wine atlas is so helpful, because I think one of the things that Americans are a little bit confused about is that it doesn't matter how many different grape varieties you know. Like, you think that you like Pinot Noir, you think that you like Cabernet Sauvignon, that may be true. But do you like Cabernet Sauvignon from Napa Valley and from, you know, the Languedoc or the Loire? Or, you know, do you like Cab Sav from Argentina, or do you like it from, you know, Sonoma? Like, Americans learn by grape variety first, by and large. And so it's very confusing for them to know that there are all of these European countries out there that name their wines by place and by a lot of different other things. And then all the other new world wines have grape varieties on them. So that can feel really hard to parse. An atlas really helps. Just a little, like, even a simple one, so that you can be like, okay, I picked up this bottle of, you know, weird little Sangiovese from where in the world. And I can look up the producer and I can figure out what country it came from. And I can figure out what region it came from and be like, okay, Tuscany. You know, like, now I know that I'm interested in Tuscany, and I can go into a wine store or into a restaurant and be like, can I have something from Tuscany? You know, and you can sort of, like, build up your little vocabulary from there, figure out what regions you're interested in first, and sort of, I always recommend to staff members that they drink regionally. Like, if they stumble across a bottle that they really dig, then they should drink other things from that place. And then that kind of, like, builds your repertoire.
Yeah, and then what? Like, let's use me as an example. Like, really, and it's funny, all these years being here, all I know is that I like wines from Piedmont.
Great.
Right? But then, like, then what? Do you just kind of jump somewhere else and see
no,
if you
no,
like
no, no,
it?
No, you travel across the world, right? So, like, you've got your Atlas, and you've got your Piemonte Nebbiolo that you like so much, and you know, maybe a couple other weird little grapes. You like Arbaluce and Arnaise too. And then you open up your little wine atlas and you go, okay, what's next to the Piedmont? And you go, right north of that is Valdosta.
So you stay close and kind of work your way around.
Sure, why not? I mean, it's a great way to be like, okay, what is it about the Piedmont that I dig? Well, I don't really know. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should check out, you know, Switzerland. Or maybe I should go just due east of the Piedmont and see if I like what's in that region next to it. You know, or just due south in Liguria and see if I dig that. You know what I mean? Like, it's, there's a way of going about this that doesn't feel so random and that also doesn't make you reliant on, like, you know, wine publications that...
Right,
that,
rating systems
and
stuff.
Yeah. Maps are a great way to actually learn where your wine is from and for you to kind of explore on your own. And I really like that a lot.
Awesome. Good tips. Last wine question before I ask you a few more things. If I said to you, you could take home one red and one white from the current list right now at Roberta's, what would you be taking home?
Oh, man, that's tough.
Tough, right?
Sometimes I just stand in storage and I look at all of them and I go, which ones of you are my favorite?
Yeah.
which is, you know, it's like, which child do you favor the most? Let's see. On the red front, there is this one wine from Abruzzo that since it's gotten cold, I've really been like had a hankering for it. It's Montepulciano d'Abruzzo from Presidium is the producer, and it's a 2001, which means it's got a little bit of age on it, and it is just this like bloody iron driven old man's wine, and it smells like flowers at first, and then it starts to open up, and it's just like, whoa, this is weird old Italy that used to have Roman blood all over it, you know. And that I really dig that bottle. And I normally don't want to drink things like that, but since it's gotten cold, I really I've been feeling it.
Yeah,
that one's
like
fun.
Winter, yeah.
And then for white, I really like a lot of what's happening on our little French white section right now. And there's a little natural winemaker that I got introduced to recently named Didier Chaffaudon from the Loire. And there's this bizarre wine that I have on the list. It's a Chenin Blanc from the Loire Valley. And it's the proprietary name of the wine is Mentul Matagrabolise, which I'm butchering, but it means the overthinking penis. And I'm not entirely sure how that name corresponds to the wine, but it is one of the most kind of raw and clear and delicious Chenins I've probably ever had. It's super savory and has lots of minerality in it, but it's kind of unique. I've never really had anything like it. I've been really digging that a lot lately, too.
Dope. Listeners, Google and bookmark those. Come back and see them. So before the show is up, we have a few more minutes, but we have to touch on the fact that you're a published poet, and I mean, like, I'm looking here, and the first edition of this last work is sold out. I mean, you do well.
I do well in terms of independent poetry publishing, which is a sad and sweet little affair. you know, my first edition print run of my book was 100 copies, so it's not that crazy.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I got a master's degree in creative writing and poetry, and that was a very life-changing thing for me. And it is a pursuit that I don't do for money, and I do it for the sake of doing it because I love it. And the community that of poets and of people who write and read poetry in the United States is pretty amazing. And it's funny because sometimes people will ask me like, "Oh, poetry and wine, like it's amazing. Those things link up so well together." And I find myself a little bit annoyed with that because, mm-hmm. you know, it's like. That belongs to an old way of thinking about wine that's super romanticized when in fact the stuff is just fermented grape juice. You know, it happens to be really special and sometimes extraordinary grape juice. But it's like, you know, this is an agricultural thing and this is, you know, a thing that farmers do and workers do. And, you know, and so is poetry. You know what I mean? It's not something that belongs to this kind of obscure and obtuse way of life.
Amen. I like always have the same reaction when I hear people talk about pairing wines with songs or like,
oh, give me a
break, right?
Dude.
Exactly.
Just spare me.
I feel you. I won't name names, but yes. But talk to me about Imperial Bender. That's like the work I'm seeing here. Is this your most recent?
Yeah. That was published in 2013, so just last year.
cool. So it's a collection of poems. Any underlying theme or what's?
Yeah, they are all loosely correlated to a couple year chapter in my life where I was having a lot of fun, namely drinking too much. And hanging out with restaurants and restaurant people. But also I was in the middle of kind of grieving the loss of a mentor, and it was a really, really difficult time. And one of my first sort of intense bouts with losing somebody to cancer. And I was kind of grappling with that in a lot of different ways. You know, and just sort of the major themes of poetry, you know, drinking too much and losing people.
Yeah, there's the connection. No, I mean, but what's awesome to me is that you're still working in this field. I feel like a lot of people in the hospitality industry speak of like their past career as a musician or a writer, and then they stopped doing that. But I mean, you're still working.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of that is because the people who run this restaurant are flexible humans. There was a point when, you know, working in the wine business and in the restaurant business in particular can mean long hours, as any cook or any manager knows, and it can be hard on you. But I'm really lucky. The people that I work for have there are people who are interested in the arts, obviously, or this radio station wouldn't be housed inside their restaurant.
Real talk.
You know? And so when I said, like, hey, guys, I haven't read a book in almost a year. What can we do? They were like, okay, let's talk. You know, and that flexibility has been helpful. I think without the right amount of time, it's very, very hard to continue working in the arts.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I feel like we really learned a lot. You know, it's not every week that you learn something on Roberta's Radio. It's a crapshoot. You don't really know.
Well, next time we do this, Jack, I'm not going to teach anything at all, and I'm going to tell my own story of Thanksgiving.
Yeah, please. We need more. I think maybe we'll just do Thanksgiving from now until the New Year's and see how many stories we can get.
I'm sure we could lend something to that.
For real. Where can people find your work? If they want to.
Amazon is probably the easiest thing, but it is on the publisher's website too, which is Typecast Publishing. But yeah, you can find me if you Google me.
Dope. And that, you know, come to Roberta's, ask about the wine, know that you can drink anything with pizza, don't be scared, drink something delicious. Thanks for listening, and thanks, Amanda, for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jack.
Really appreciate it. And next week we got Carrie Black, the guy that started Bonnaroo. It should be fun. Falco will be back in, and we'll figure out how the hell Bonnaroo took off and how that all happened. Until then, you can listen to all the episodes of Roberta's Radio on heritageradionetwork.org or iTunes. Like I said, we're live every Tuesday, 7 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. And I'm going to play some more music from the playlist Kristen gave us. Thank you, Kristen. And we will see you guys next week. Peace. Tell me how you feel me, feeling you.
listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.